about the U.S., whether it's Iran or potential conflict in Venezuela. What is the strategy? And strategy was kind of on display at the meeting that Secretary of War Hegseth and President Trump addressed yesterday with all those generals. One of the things that Hegseth said is that he was looking for a ways to reduce some of the overhead in some of the generals. Now, a paper that you authored that I know through probably several different avenues, you got into senior administration officials right around the time of the inauguration as a means of here is a good strategy. It says the United States is navigating a fiscal storm that demands a significant course correction in its defense strategy, leadership, and mindset. The current defense policy, anchored in obsolete structures and strategies, is akin to a ship too costly to maintain and ill-equipped to sail the complex waters of this century. This paper advocates for a daring new approach to national defense, seizing the fiscal crisis as a catalyst to trim the fat, streamline investments, and reset our force structure by adopting a new grand strategy that prioritizes diplomacy and peaceful cooperation. I love that line. The U.S. can gain a competitive edge in future warfare and strengthen national security. Love every one of those things. Now, I know for sure that because I know at some of the highest levels of cabinet level, I know for in one case that was given to some members of the president's administration, but haven't seen hardly anything happen about that since then. But now here's a comment yesterday that Secretary Hegseth said that when I read your paper, I'm thinking this sounds familiar.
I have fired a number of senior officers since taking over. The previous chairman, other members of the Joint Chiefs, combatant commanders, and other commanders. The rationale for me has been straightforward. It's nearly impossible to change a culture with the same people who helped create or even benefited from that culture, even if that culture was created by a previous president and previous secretary. But in many ways, it's not their fault. It's not your fault. As foolish and reckless as the woke department was, those officers were following elected political leadership. An entire generation of generals and admirals were told that they must parrot the insane fallacy that, quote, our diversity is our strength. Of course, we know our unity is our strength. They had to put out dizzying DEI and LGBTQI+ statements. They were told females and males are the same thing, or that males who think they're females is totally normal. They were told that we need a green fleet and electric tanks. They were told to kick out Americans who refuse an emergency vaccine. They followed civilian policies set by foolish and reckless political leaders.
The part that really got my attention was that he was saying the culture that helped make the system is not going to be able to reform the system, which was one of the headlines or one of the important parts that you wrote in that. So it sounds like that they received part of that, but then the way they're executing it is not quite so far. What can you tell us about the paper? And we're going to get into the details of the paper itself, but what can you tell us about how it was received at the administration as far as you know?
Well, the paper that you've got and that I hope people will read was delivered by me at the request of RFK Jr. People are not aware of it, but I actually supported RFK Jr. for the presidency. And then he made the decision to join the Trump team. And we had several discussions and, he said, why don't you write a paper on what you think ought to happen and send it to me? And that's what I did. And that's the paper that you've got. And he looked it over and he said, that's great. And he gave it to President Trump. Don Jr. allegedly received a copy. So did Tulsi Gabbard. I'm told that eventually copies found their way into numerous people's hands. And I'm quite confident, even though Hegseth at that point had not yet been identified, at least not publicly, I'm sure that his team, because I know one or two people working for him right now, actually had a copy of the paper and they probably pulled things out of it. In fact, I know they did, and that's fine. I'm glad they did, even if they got it wrong, and they did get some things wrong. He talks later on about 4 stars and 5 stars. He doesn't understand that until the war was almost over, we only had 7 4-stars for 12 million soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. That's quite a ratio. I mean, if you look at, 43 right now or 42 for 1.18 million versus 7 for 12 million, that suggests that we ran things a lot differently. And in fact, Marshall was approached all the time, over and over and over. You need to promote so-and-so to 4 stars. I would like you to do this. He said, no, Senator, I can't do that. And finally, several senators said, why not? He said, because I don't have time to argue. I have to win the war. And remember, he already had 3 other 4 stars in Army uniform that he had to argue with. One was MacArthur, one was Arnold, and one was Eisenhower. And of those three, the only guy he really had to argue with from time to time was MacArthur. And contrary to popular belief, Marshall and MacArthur had a great deal of respect for each other, and he listened to MacArthur because he respected his experience and his strategic thinking. You only had 3 in the Navy. Leahy, who had been Chief of Naval Operations, he worked for FDR as effectively his senior military advisor, and we would today call that the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And then you had King, and you had Nimitz. That was it. Those are the only 4 stars. And it stayed that way until the war almost ended. And then they started promoting people within the last 6 months of the war as thank you for coming promotions. We call them honorifics. You did a great job. You get a 4-star. And the other thing very few people understand is that until after World War II, when you retired in the United States Army, I think it was true in the Navy as well, if you had 3 or 4 stars, it didn't matter. You reverted to 2 stars. There were no permanent ranks over 2 stars. Everyone went back to being a major general. The first exception to that was Pershing after World War I. They called him General of the Armies, remember, and he got to be a 4-star. The point is that we've been through at least 80 years of rank inflation and bureaucratic bloat beyond anybody's imagination because we built a force for global military hegemony. And that was done under the guise of containing communism. Well, that's over. And the worst part is we can't afford it. We're just broke. And so my assumption, and I think RFK Jr. believed this strongly, we have to deal with the fiscal crisis. We have to cut spending. Well, boy, we were wrong. We're not cutting anything. The Democrats have a $3 trillion deficit for their budget. The Republicans have a $2 trillion deficit for their budget. Who are we kidding? We're spending worse than we ever have.
And as it turns out, though, I think that Secretary Hegseth did read your paper because he actually said something. It's been almost 4 months ago that he said this, but he laid out a marker of what they are going to try to do to reduce, and that is cull the general officer corps.
In history, when we were fighting across the globe during World War II, we had a force that was 12 million strong. For that 12 million man element, we had 17 4- and 5-star generals. Today, we have 2.1 million service members with 44 4-star and flag officers. So it used to be a ratio of 1 general to 6,000 troops. Today, it's 1 general to 1,400.
So, yeah, that's nearly straight out of your paper.
Well, except that he got it wrong on the 17. That's all. The other 10 are promotions that come towards the end of the war. The operational conduct of the war, the strategic planning and direction, was done by 7 men. That's what needs to be understood. So in the paper, when I restructured the unified commands, the functional commands, the services, everything, I was able to get the numbers of 4 stars from roughly 43 or 44, whatever it is right now, down to 10. Now, somebody said, well, what difference does that make? Change, fundamental change, structurally, culturally, happens from the top down in the military. It doesn't start at the bottom and work its way up. If you do not fundamentally adopt a new strategy and then adapt that structure to the new strategy, nothing changes, which is why simply eliminating 20% of the 4 stars sounds like a great idea. It's not going to fundamentally change anything. In fact, based on the last 80 years of experience, if you try to eliminate a certain number of generals without changing the structure, eventually they come back. It's sort of like a Stephen King movie. If you don't drive a stake through the heart of the structure, they come back. And so just getting rid of 20% of the generals, 4 or 5 years from now, they could all be reconstituted. So what you've got to do is change the structure. But without a new strategy, you don't get a change in the structure. And I remember the Army Chief of Staff, in fact, my classmate at West Point, Ray Odierno, said something I thought was very intelligent and very important. He said, you keep asking us to do more with less. How about asking us to do less with less? And he was right. Everything is overstretched. And now you have the potential for three giant military confrontations. One in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine or central Ukraine, whatever it turns out to be. One in the Middle East. It could involve everybody at some point. And now Venezuela, which I think could become the cause célèbre for the Latin American world against us. So it's sheer lunacy. We're not only not shedding unnecessary inventories of old equipment. We're not changing the structure, changing the way we fight. We're not coming to terms with any of those things. We're just spending more money.
And I want to get into some of the specific parts of your paper, because I think it's really important for people to understand what a strategy, a combined strategy with the equipment, with manpower, what that actually looks like and how it's attainable. But I want to go, first of all, one more time back to Secretary Hegseth, because whereas he does say, I want to get rid of this percentage-wise of the General Officer Corps, he's going to then now here explain how he's going to do it. But to my ear, I don't hear the strategy part governing the change of the structure. Watch this.
Now, this is not a slash and burn exercise meant to punish high-ranking officers. Nothing could be further from the truth. This has been a deliberative process, working with the Joint Chiefs of Staff with one goal, maximizing strategic readiness and operational effectiveness by making prudent reductions in the general and flag officer ranks. So there's two phases here. Phase one, we're looking at our current service structure. And in phase two, it's a strategic review of the unified command plan. Now, this is going to be, we think, the most comprehensive review since the Goldwater-Nichols Defense Reorganization Act of 1986. It's going to be done carefully, but it's going to be done expeditiously. We confront a complex and evolving threat environment. We cannot afford to wait. We got to be lean and mean. And in this case, it means general officer reductions.
Is he focused on the right thing there by just want general officer reductions and a Barry Goldwater type renovation? I just don't understand. I'm not clear because he hasn't conveyed it what that means. Now, you wrote in here that the first step is to come up with a new grand strategy. I wonder if you can explain that.
Well, you'll note that in the grand strategy, I also talk about how warfare has changed, how technology has changed, and why large numbers of forces forward deployed in various countries around the world and forward deployed naval forces are now sitting ducks. In other words, they've just added to a target array that in the event of a major war with any capable adversary, you risk losing everything that is forward deployed very quickly. That you live in an environment where you're not going to move hundreds of thousands, let alone a million men across the Atlantic or the Pacific to land in somebody else's country. Those days are over. So you have to determine that your number one priority is going to have to be defense of the Western Hemisphere, the United States, and its vital strategic interests. That means you're going to scale back these 800 bases overseas. You're going to have to look at those and determine what you need and what you don't. And you're also going to have to do something that we seem to really dislike, and that is develop a diplomatic approach to your friends and potential opponents. In other words, if you look at Venezuela, the only thing we've done to Venezuela is sanction the living daylights out of it to try and destroy its economy. What would happen if you went in and offered to relieve those sanctions and actually offered assistance and made it clear that what you don't want is a direct military confrontation? What kind of response would you get? Could you avoid the military confrontation that now seems inevitable? Well, the usual suspects in Washington, the neocons, have been riding the tidal wave now for years. So absolutely not. You can't compromise anything with them. Every event is another fight with Hitler. And anyone who suggests otherwise is a Neville Chamberlain, sort of selling out his country and pacifying the evil ones. You got to get rid of all that nonsense. You got to change the way you look at the rest of the world and acknowledge that there are lots of middleweight powers right now that may not be as great and powerful as we are, but they have the capacity to do enormous damage to us. And it's damage we don't need to sustain. So the world itself fundamentally has changed.
So if we need a new strategy, And it's especially if it sharply scales back U.S. abroad, what should the new strategy be? And if you scale back, where do you scale up?
Well, I think if you look at the 5 points for the foundation of a new national military strategy, I say, first of all, defend America first. You know, it's Western Hemisphere, secure the U.S. borders, coastal waters and airspace. Military power may be used to defend American citizens and identified interests at home and abroad. However, and this is very important, unless the United States' vital strategic interests or its territory are directly attacked, Washington will and should avoid the use of force. Second, you maintain enough strategic power to ensure freedom of action in areas of importance by preserving our core capabilities. That means you identify, defend, and maintain critical lines of communication at a reduced number of overseas bases needed for the execution of these tasks. You declare, and this is extremely important and needs to happen as soon as possible, you declare a no first use doctrine for nuclear weapons. Now, that means you maintain the scientific industrial power to wage high end conventional warfare. That's what you've seen in eastern Ukraine. That's what the Russians have done. You build nuclear weapons, but you recognize that the alleged advantage of striking first is illusory. You know, you strike first, they return instantly with everything they have. Then establish an operational national defense staff. We have no real general staff system. We don't identify people on the basis of demonstrated character, competence, and intelligence for advancement to high rank to do the complex planning and staff work that's required. We need a merit-based system. That means people need to be subjected to examinations. They need to prove themselves, their intelligence and ability. And then that chief of defense replaces this thing called the chairman. He's no longer just the senior military advisor to the president. The chief of defense has real authority. And that's very important because right now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs commands nothing. Then you need to build new armed forces for the 21st century. That's going to take time. Just overhauling the anachronistic World War II structure is not the answer. If you're going to build a new car, you don't bring out the Ford Fairlane 500, give it a new paint job, replace engine parts, put it out there and say, this is the new force. No, you get rid of the Ford Fairlane. You build a new car. What that looks like, if it's a Ferrari or a Porsche, I have no idea. But my point is, you have to go through experimentation. And you know from your own experience on the, was it Force 21 or
Future Combat Systems?
That's right. There have been so many of these phony.
Right. I can attest to that.
Yeah. You've got to have an environment in which you have people that are isolated from the rest of the force. They're independently commanded and they are given technologies that become capabilities and you employ them and you learn what they can and cannot do. And you prevent people from stopping change by doing that. You come out with real answers, but that means real experimentation and that takes time. So all of those things are very important. They all have to happen in the national military strategy. I hope that we get there. It's going to be tough because you're trying to fight potentially three wars at once. Washington hasn't done very well at fighting just one war at once.
Now, you mentioned that you would have to change the force design, that it could take a decade or so from some of your books, especially.
Yes.
What would the force designs to implement this strategy you just laid out? What would that look like?
Well, I sent you the paper, and, you know, we probably should look at those two yeah. illustrations. Can we do that?
Yeah, bring chart one up.
You know, this is very important because we tend to look at everything in the military from the vantage point of services. Everything is service-centric. If you sit down with the chief of service, everything he says is designed to enhance, preserve, stabilize, and improve, you know, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines. But warfare has changed dramatically. And we need to get more return on our investment. We spend more and more and more money with each passing year, month, decade. And what do we come out with? We come out with some version of the same old thing, and it's not performing to expectation. And war is more than hitting a button and firing a missile. So if you look at the right-hand illustration, it divides everything up into four components: intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, strike, which means anything beyond line of sight, maneuver, that means ground forces maneuvering, and sustainment, which is logistics. We need to change our investment scheme. We need to put most of our investments at this point into intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets from seabed to space. And we need to put more money into strike and integrated air defenses. We have no integrated air defense at all for the North America. None. I mean, we've depended exclusively on the U.S. Air Force to scramble jets, fly out there and shoot something down. Those days are over. We're going to be attacked by missiles in the future. We're being attacked by them now. And all sorts of unmanned systems demands a different force design. And then your maneuver will look at this and say, well, that's not enough money for us. We need more maneuver. But we're not going to send a million men overseas to re-land at Normandy. It's not going to happen. So if we're not going to send hundreds of thousands overseas anymore, which I think new technology makes prohibitive, then you've got to structure that force to operate within this ISR strike umbrella. That means that they'll be protected by it as well as facilitated, enabled by it. So that streamlines your investments. That tells you where do you put your money for the foreseeable future. We haven't done that.
And how, Doug, how have you seen that play? Because I know a lot of those concepts you wrote going all the way back to the 1997 book, Breaking the Phalanx, and then several others that you published over the years. But now then we have some tangible physical evidence of peer-on-peer war with the Russian and Ukrainian armies. How have you seen those things actually play out, and has it modified your original thoughts any?
Well, I think what you've seen now in eastern Ukraine is a validation of the ISR strike complex, which I outlined in the third book called Transformation Under Fire. And that is that you build a force design and command structures designed to maximize the striking power of your long, medium range strike assets. What this effectively means is that you build a system, so much as we've seen with the Russians, if you assemble a large number of troops in an assembly area, it's immediately identified, and you have the ability to mobilize strike assets at sea, in the air, on the ground, across a 1,000-mile front to attack that assembled force within minutes and annihilate it. So at this point, if you're a Ukrainian, you have no means of maneuver anymore because you are now under persistent surveillance, and the Russians have innumerable strike assets with which to destroy your force. That is the sort of realization of the revolution in military affairs that people talked about in the 70s. Well, it's happened. And the only thing that AI, artificial intelligence or robotics can do is further strengthen, reinforce, and speed up that whole process.
And so I guess to what extent would you say that the focus on large-scale maneuver, which I think probably we still do. As a matter of fact, I was looking for the headline to see if I could find it here. This story about a month or so back to when the U.S. released some updated technical manuals, about how especially armored forces were supposed to operate in this new drone environment based on the results there. And it was literally laughed at, not by the Russian army, but by the Ukrainian army. They said that this would never, ever work, but that implies that we're trying to take lessons in the current force and just slightly modify them to fit what we were doing before, as opposed to the wholesale paradigm change, which if I hear you correctly, like the Russians have definitely gone away from these big battalion strike groups that they use at the start to now disjointed things with, three and five man groups, mainly on the ground and motorcycles and other things to avoid the drones. Have we changed properly, or do we need to do something different?
Well, this goes back to experimentation, and you have to protect the experimentation from this condition called presentism. In other words, there's always the predisposition of the professional soldier that has served for 25 or 30 years to look at something and say, how do I rig this outcome to ensure that nothing really puts the force I've lived in for so many years at risk? Do you understand what I'm saying? This is very important. In other words, we went through this during the interwar period where the cavalry and the artillery worked tirelessly to prevent mechanization. They worked tirelessly to prevent armored forces from emerging. You had this mentality in the U.S. Army Air Corps about the bomber. They kept insisting, all we need are bombers. If we deliver enough bombs, we'll win the war and nobody else has to fight. And so we lost thousands of men and thousands of bombers ultimately because there were no fighter escorts. Ultimately, we finally broke down and said, yeah, we need fighter escorts or the bombers are never going to get through. That was after we and the British lost 18,000 bombers. I mean, this sort of thing goes on. So what you're saying is a very important point. What has worked on the Ukrainian battlefield for the Russians? Is there a way to build in those lessons, those insights, so that we can make things work for us? I think the answer is yes. But we need to go out and experiment, and we need to be realistic. And that's why the Ukrainians laughed, because they're living literally in the middle of a target array. They are under constant bombardment from these massive numbers of strike systems. They are under persistent surveillance. So they're making the right comments. They're making the right points. I just don't know that we are open to it. But this is where the Secretary of War, as he calls himself now, steps in. And you set up not just a service pure experimentation, although some of that needs to happen at the lowest level, but you also need integration across service lines for what I call all arms, all effects warfare, so that you get a real picture of what the holistic outcome is. This takes time. A lot of time. This is not something you snap your fingers and create overnight, but it can be done. You know, the Germans started out with essentially trucks and what you would call the equivalent of a Jeep running around with some tin welded to them, you know, light skin vehicles, radios stuck in them, a few machine guns. And since they had no heavy guns, they stuck tubes to, you know, simulate tank guns. They started out in 1930, and by 1935, they had developed the new divisional structure, which had two full-strength battle groups in it that were mobile and armored. Those two battle groups were roughly 5,000 men each, and above that, you had some logistics, and then at the top, the command structure. Everybody looked at this and said, we think this is about right. And so Hitler made the decision to expand the numbers of divisions, and they went from zero armor division to the one that was based on experimentation to instantly overnight, almost 10. When I say instantly, I'm talking over a few years.
Yeah.
This force goes into Poland. It wasn't perfect. They learned a lot of tough lessons. Contrary to popular belief, the Poles fought very effectively against the Germans. The Germans took losses. They sat down, they had a come to Jesus meeting and said, well, we got a lot right, but we also got some things wrong. So they changed things. So by the time you go into France, you've got a different force, different tactics, different operational thinking. And then finally, by the time you get to Russia, you've got a new army. I mean, my point is that you can make these changes, but the first part is this core of experimentation that has to be honest and open. And you have to be prepared to jettison what doesn't work anymore. Dump it. Forget it.
And that honesty, that intellectual honesty is what is, in my view, absolutely absent among the senior leaders. And I watched it in the Future Combat Systems when we faked all of these experimentations that you're talking about in lieu of what we wanted the outcome to be, no matter what it actually was. And we paid the price for that. And now then, in the last bit of time we have here, I'd like to, you know, have you go over how you would see actually changing out, because if you don't get out the top change, like you said in there, if the guys who are responsible and benefit from the culture as it is are going to resist it, so you have to get a new one. Therefore, you have to replace a lot of these generals. So that's a hard deal. How would you effectively replace a new generation of leaders that could do this kind of experimentation?
Well, I think there are two ways. I mean, we'll look at that slide in a minute that gives you a snapshot of what the top looks like. But again, go back to George Marshall. And George Marshall had a man under his command, a major general named John K. Herr. John K. Herr was the chief of cavalry. And he famously told Marshall, this is after the German performance in Poland, after the Germans had overrun France and the Low Countries. He saw the value of mechanization and armored mobility and firepower. And John K. Hurt told George Marshall, a tank runs out of fuel after a couple of days, but a horse takes several days to die. In other words, don't give up your horses yet. They'll outlast your tanks. Well, Hur was a distinguished soldier, highly decorated, fought throughout the First World War. Marshall, by the way, was never in combat during the First World War. He was a staff officer. But Hur had seen a lot of action, Silver Star, he may have had the DSC. Marshall had a lot of respect for him, for his courage and professionalism, but that was the wrong answer. So Hur was marginalized and eventually retired. That's, you've got to approach this with the same points in mind. But rather than go around and identify people on the basis of what you think their personal views are of policy, whether it's DEI or affirmative action or something else, you've got to get to a new structure. And if you put that slide up that shows how you go from 44 four stars down to 10, this is how you do it. If you look to the left, there are all the structures and commands that justify four stars. For instance, until until World War II, the vice chief of staff of the Army was always a three-star, and that was true for the Navy as well. You only had one four-star in the Army, and that was George Marshall. Well, we've got to go back to something like that. But I have gone actually further. I've tried to convert the chiefs of staff to commanders of U.S. ground forces, maritime forces, air, missile, and space defense forces. The other thing is that I know we've changed this word to war from Department of Defense, but I think we need to think very hard about defending ourselves because technology points to future vulnerabilities of us here in our home country. And then I've reduced the numbers of commands. So you now have Northern, Southern, Atlantic, and Pacific. I understand that they want to combine Northern and Southern Command, but that still leaves you with Central Command, European Command, Africa Command. Those all need to go away. And that's going to be a big fight because you have various lobbies that are going to insist that you have a Central Command. If you try to eliminate Central Command right now, the whole Israel lobby will go to war with you because Central Command is effectively Israel Command. U.S. European Command is the command that has been running the operations against the Russians in Ukraine. And so everybody will say, you can't do that. Well, you can do it all, and it all needs to be done. But it needs decisiveness and effective leadership and systematic planning and also a recognition that we're probably going to see a 50% cut in defense coming. And then at the bottom, you end up with the Strategic Operations Command, Support Command, and Deterrence Command. Look on the left at all the different kinds of commands that you have. In other words, you're consolidating these functions in a way that is effective, but it's going to hurt people's feelings. I mean, people in Special Operations Command think they should be their own world, that they should be their own service. You know, the last thing we need are more services. I know Donald Trump got excited over Space Command, but we don't need another service. You can do what Space Command does, but you put it under the commander of U.S. Aerospace Forces and Space Forces and Air Force and everything else. Anyhow, this can all be done. It makes sense. It'll save us a lot of money. I think it'll make us a better fighting force. But we still need the change in the national military strategy that puts more emphasis on defense. Right now, we're built for offensive warfare everywhere. And that is a loser. It's a loser financially. It's not necessary.
And, you know, historically, Doug, I think that you just aren't going to get these kind of changes unless you are on the coals of a defeat and the wreckage that we've had. Because I think you absolutely hit it on the head there. Every change you would propose making, there's a deeply entrenched in constituency that would fight tooth and nail against any of the changes, much less. And I think we need all of them to have an overall strategy. And I think the only way we get there, and please tell me I'm wrong, is if we get defeated somewhere in battle and now then we have the wreckage and everyone recognizes it's a failure. Otherwise, I don't know how we get to this better place.
Well, I think that's part of it, but it's also, there has to be a recognition that Vietnam was a strategic disaster. There needs to be a recognition that Afghanistan and Iraq were strategic disasters. If anyone thinks that Iraq is now a staunch ally of the United States as a result of our liberation, is insane. You know, the Afghans just told President Trump, for all intents and purposes, to stuff it over Bagram Air Base. Well, let's wake up and smell the coffee. We haven't had any successful military operations. And, oh, yeah, you'll find innumerable generals. Well, we won all the battles. How many times have I heard that? You know, we won every major battle in Vietnam, yeah, and we lost the war. We have a serious problem with strategy and thinking. And unfortunately, because we've allowed these losses to go unpunished, all of these generals are drawing six and seven figure salaries in retirement working for the defense industry, because ultimately, whether you win or lose, the defense industry is principally concerned with what? Making money. We have to realize that. Stop pretending that we have altruistic people in the defense industry. They are interested in making money. And if you are a guy that the administration likes and you're retired, they'll use you in order to get to more cash. That's all it's about. So you need a truthful, objective assessment of what's been going on for the past 50 years. And I don't see any good news, to be frank with you. I see nothing but disaster. But there's one other factor that has to be taken into account, and that is bankruptcy. We are closer now than perhaps we've ever been in our entire history to financial disaster. Gold is now the reserve currency, not the dollar. The world is de-dollarizing. And our monopoly of control over the institutions of financial power is just about gone because of an organization called BRICS. And all the military power that we mobilize is not going to change that. That's something we need to understand.
Well, we should understand it. I'm not sure that we do. I guess we'll have to wait and see how that folds out. But whatever the case is, one of the reasons we have this channel is because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring people the truth. And we need people. I want to make sure that everybody sees there is a blueprint out there, has been since 1997 with your first book. But we can have a much more powerful military that's actually defending us and is something that we can afford long term. If only we had the vision and the wisdom and the leadership to get it done. But it's out there, and you've done your best, and you've done your part. Now we have to see if we can get the rest of our leadership to do the next steps. But we appreciate you pointing these things out, Doug. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys as well. Be sure and go to your podcast. I know a lot of your friends actually prefer to get their information on podcasts. Don't miss this chance to let them know so they don't miss stuff like this too. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict, everywhere you get your podcast, type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive and you'll find us there. And of course, for those who prefer the written topic, we have that as well. DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. And you can find all those things there. You actually get a double shot there, both the videos and the written format. So be sure and share this around, folks. Don't keep it with you. I would like you to like and subscribe this video and this channel. If you haven't already done that, that helps us too. But man, these things really help your friends. So share this with folks. Don't keep it to yourself. And we'll appreciate that a lot. And we will look forward to seeing you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.